Shalom, everybody, and welcome to the Yishai Fleisher Show, broadcasting live from Jerusalem to the world. You're a part of it wherever you are. Shalom and welcome to the Pardes Institute, and shalom and welcome to Rabbi Mike Foyer.
Oh, shalom, Yishai. Good to see you.
Great to see you today. We have a Torah portion, which is... I've been stressing about how to do this right on the show today.
I see a little crease between your eyes.
Because it's no narrative. It's a no narrative thing.
And it's a no nonsense portion.
That's right. And we have actually talked about this every year that we've done the show together on this issue, that this is a transition moment. In many ways, it's a grown-up moment.
Yes. Right?
It's a grow-up moment. So the Exodus happened. You've been fed the little manna. You got the little food. You're happy now.
Drama.
You got your water. You got all your things. You sang a song. Okay, let's get down to business. Here's the law, right? And the Torah portion is called Mishpatim, which are the laws that are laid out. And we have with us today 53 new commandments that are going to be dealt with in this Torah portion.
Just so people can appreciate, there are three commandments in all of the book of Bereishit.
Right.
And we're not even halfway through the book of Shemot, and this 53 will bring us close to 100 that we've seen basically since God said, mark the new moon.
Right.
So this is a tremendous surge in the commanded relationship.
Right. And what I meant by grow up is, okay, now I'm going to get to the real meat of the Torah. I gave you the light and fire show, right? I gave you the
drama.
The drama, the
entertainment.
You saw it, you felt it, you were there, you touched it. Now we're going to talk about things like your ox eating somebody else's field.
That's right.
We're going to deal with nitty gritty, and that's what this Torah is also
real
here
life.
To tell you, right? So if you're like into Bible drama, suddenly you got to shift a different gear here, and you've got to enter right real life. So just before we go on, the world is being plagued right now.
Literally, the
coronavirus is now going into other countries, into Korea.
Did you hear about this cruise ship in Cambodia where they like didn't stop anybody from disembarking? And now they started to find at least one person who actually has the virus.
It looks like Cambodian sanitation is not up to par.
They blew it, dude.
They blew it.
They blew it, and it's a multi-continent problem now.
It's not really funny, but
Israel's barring the gates.
Israel's barring the gates, and even America, by the way, I heard that there was some ship that people got off and they sent them home, and all kinds of stuff with quarantines and issues. Listen, the bottom line is that there's disease. What's the scope of it? I'm sure there are listeners right now who are saying, you know, you guys are overblowing it up. It's all smoke and mirrors. Other people say, you don't know what you're talking about. Millions are dead. This is a
plague. Rumors out there in social media are rampant.
Right. And there are crazy videos, and you don't know if they're made up or this and that. You just don't even know anymore. You just don't even know the truth.
Which is itself a problem.
Right, which is weird because we live in the age of ostensible information.
Yeah, but, you know, like once someone, I forget who said it, someone once said to me that this was a long time ago too, is that the internet is the closest approximation to a library of all the world's knowledge. The only problem is that all the books are on the floor and their covers have been torn off.
Mm-hmm.
Right? I mean, you don't really know. You can't really differentiate between truth and fiction on some level.
Right. And also, as we talked about before the show, the Chinese government is also clamping down on real information.
Notoriously, you know, well known for their honesty and forthrightness.
That's right. And the only reason I mention this is because I heard yesterday in the I daven in a Chabad synagogue in the mornings often, and the rabbi there, it's the whole Chabad world. We do things according to the Chabad way.
Meaning it was like 10:30.
No, it was 9:45 when we start davening at about 8:40.
Uh-huh.
Okay, and I never did this. I changed my whole, because that shul is downstairs for me. It's because the only shul that I feel good in. So I changed my whole life. I still wake up early. I just do work early, and then I take the kids, and then I go to shul. It's like a crazy thing. I know you daven very early.
Yeah.
Well. Daven is the Yiddish word for prayer. Pray, and you know, we have the morning prayers. But in any case, the Chabad shul there has Chabad stuff, including they read from this compendium that they have called Hayom Yom. It's a, you know, it's got a short little
day by day,
you know, Lubavitch Chabad info second there. And
by the way, I'm giving bonus points if anybody can get the song that I just trilled there for
you. What was it? Do it again.
Day by day.
Okay. So hashtag day by day. I don't know that
There's
one.
There's an irony in there, but okay. We'll leave it to those who know.
See, this happens from time to time. It flew right over my head. And I'll have to look
it
up.
My Broadway background.
Okay. All right.
It's a hint.
Okay, that's a hint of why I don't know it. Okay, I don't know Broadway
Moving
songs.
Moving on, sorry, yeah. I couldn't resist.
It's all good. People love that stuff. So anyway, the Yom Yom and the Day by Day, it said there are human laws which come as a reaction to life.
Mm-hmm.
Human laws come as a reaction to life.
Sure, we got
to
clamp down, we got to lay the rules, we got to whatever.
The experience shows that X, Y, and Z.
There's a need, right.
There's a need, and therefore here's a problem, and this is the law.
Mm-hmm.
And the Yom Yom said, but there are other kinds, the Torah laws, which these are the laws that give birth to life.
Yes.
Okay? As opposed to laws being born out of life, these are laws that come first and then they give life.
It's a very important perspective. And I'll tell you, I always think about that actually on Shabbat. There's a line when we pray on Shabbat that says that we inherited, or God gave us Shabbat as inheritance, b'avu v'ratzon, out of love and out of will. The love, I feel like, is a response to life. It's like, you're going to work hard. You need a break.
Right.
Like, so I'll give you Shabbos. That's a response to the human condition. Beratzon, but the divine will was such that I'm going to command them to give Shabbat, and that will shape their entire history, will shape their society. Uh-huh, like this inviolate zone here, they're simply going to have to work around it.
Right.
You know, and you think about how Shabbat has shaped our very existence.
Yeah, and last Shabbat in Shul, I talked about how Shabbat is the one commandment that is we talked about on the show, the Kedusha commandment, the holiness, the separateness, and it's also the only Am Yisrael commandment of the ten.
It's a collective, right?
Right. It's a very special commandment, number four. And so we have a lot of commandments here that are nitty gritty. You think that they're like laws of Hammurabi as a reaction to life, but that perspective is no. This is going to shape your life, and this is going to give you life. I'm going to show you how life is to be lived.
And it's important what you're saying is that, of course, there's resonance with the Hammuritic code, right?
Because, is that how you say it?
Maybe I don't know. I was making that up.
Code of Hammurabi, yeah.
Code of Hammurabi,
right?
Right? Because there's a certain unified element of human life.
Right.
The difference is that here, well, it's two differences. First of all, here that we have certain elements that simply come from above. The other one is that we can actually trust God, that God has our best interest at heart. I don't actually think that that's necessarily true about Hammurabi, right? Meaning there's a very big difference in a legal code, which is responsive to human life, that has a vision of goodness and well-being and potential what the human could be, and another, which is simply a negotiation of power.
So let's actually, for a second, riff off of that, which is that, speaking of Hammurabi, the Rashi on the first verse, which says these are the judgments that you should put before them, he says before them, but not before people who's idolaters.
Right.
And the understanding of that is you're not supposed to run to a secular court.
Correct.
Or a different nation's court. Meaning to say, if you live in America, we have a double question. We're, you know, our listeners, let's say, live abroad and outside of the land of Israel. So it means don't run to a non-Jewish court of the land. And here in Israel, what if it's a secular court and not a Torah court? Do you run there?
Big messy question. There's a rabbi in my neighborhood who is a judge in a Beit Mishpat in a secular court.
In a state-run court.
State-run court,
right,
yes.
Okay, right. With non-Torah laws binding necessarily.
Which gets messy because there are times in which what the state law dictates is theft, according to the Torah. If you're going to pass a judgment and require person A to pay person B for a certain judgment, but the Torah actually would judge it differently, you're actually committing an act of theft, potentially.
Mm-hmm,
it's
mm-hmm.
a quite complex question of how to negotiate that.
Okay, so just let's touch on that a little bit, this idea of like that you're not supposed to sell out our laws. And if you, let's say you're not getting a good judgment, here's the type of cases that we face where you didn't get a good judgment in the Torah court.
Right.
Or the Torah court isn't quite empowered.
Right. It's just an arbitration court, right, which is the situation today in the state of Israel when it comes to monetary law.
Mm-hmm.
Rabbinic courts can function as arbitration courts, mm-hmm. but should a person decide they're not going to pay, there's no sort of legal recourse. You can't call the cops,
right,
and you can't sequester their wages, you know.
But by the way, throughout the Torah career, that you learn Torah and teach Torah, at some point you meet up with a person who's a judge.
yeah,
who always, studies yeah. For not just Rabbanut.
No, Dayanut.
Dayanut.
Yeah, sure.
And it's a different kind of person.
Oh, it is a whole different level.
It's a different type of person. It's a different thing.
Yes, yes. Absolutely.
I remember in yeshiva when I first encountered it for the first time in my life. Not first, like first. I was right. like, this is a different thing that this person's doing. He's studying the law, not because it's good to study the law, and not because it's nice to know what God wants. He's studying it to pass judgment via this law. His knowledge of it must be on a completely different kind of level.
And by the way, even as someone who sometimes gets asked questions in the laws of dietary laws or et cetera, right. which is passing judgment on some level.
Sure.
There's still a completely different level of comprehension and wisdom when it comes to uprooting property from one person and giving it to another.
Right.
But you want to finish that Rashi, because here the question is not simply our laws are better than your laws, so we should stick with the Jewish courts. Rashi goes so far as to point out is that even if you know in the secular court that they will pass the exact same judgment,
right?
Nonetheless, you shouldn't go to the non-Jewish court. Why do you think that is?
To give honor or to also bear witness to that this is a godly law.
Yeah. And I think he puts this here at the beginning because it's very important. You could lose the forest for the trees like that.
Right.
Right. And so what he's pointing out is that this is not a technical system which is meant to produce interpersonal justice. It is also that. Mm-hmm. But ultimately, this is an expression of the divine will for a relationship with Am Yisrael. Mm-hmm. So therefore, even if you could produce the same interpersonal result that when my ox gores your ox, that over there in the Brooklyn federal court, they're going to pass the same judgment as they would in the Muncie Beit Din. Nevertheless, if I go to the Brooklyn federal court, I'm stepping out of the covenant and into a personal sort of question of gain and loss.
Okay, so we're talking about beautiful ideas here about respecting God. And yet, the first set of laws that we're going to deal with is slavery.
Yes.
What's that all about?
I mean, technically indentured servitude.
Right. Very good. Okay, good.
Right, because, of course, there are two frameworks for slavery in the Torah. One is...
Even the word itself, the minute you say the word slave, that's one thing, and servitude is another thing.
Yes, for sure.
I've heard people translate as slave on other podcasts, and I'm like, ooh, that's not exactly the right word, is it?
If one defines slavery as the ownership of another human being...
Yeah.
So that is not what this is.
Right.
Although I think it's important to note that the Torah does both recognize and allow for the classic institution of slavery. It was a slave culture of its time. One could make an argument that the sages, as they sort of embraced the Torah and continued to live it through time, essentially legislated the institution of slavery out of existence mm-hmm. through the power that was given to them. And that's a longer discussion about why. So people say to me, my students, for instance, if slavery is wrong, which I believe it is, then isn't the Torah being immoral by allowing for it as an institution? So you could take that absolutist stance, but always remember the Torah is not just a divine revelation. It's a means for creating a people and educating them to the divine will. Education is a process. So to eliminate one of the institutions which was a pillar of both social and economic life in the ancient world would have caused a collapse. I mean, people simply couldn't do it. And so therefore, it's recognized and institutionalized, but particularly here in the beginning of our parsha, this sort of Eved Ivri, the Hebrew slave. So within Israelite society, the allowance for indentured servitude is a way in which you create a social institution that's meant to take care of the weak as opposed to oppress them. There's two ways in which you can become a Hebrew slave. You can be caught as a thief, and if you can't pay what you've stolen, the court sells you into slavery for 7 years in order to pay it back. Or you can sell yourself into slavery because you're so poor that you can't afford to support your family.
Mm-hmm.
Which means that...
And how are you... Okay, so you sell yourself into slavery, but then the Torah will lay out very specific laws about how that servant must be treated.
So much so that in the end, the sages say, he who acquires a slave acquires for himself a master. Meaning the level of obligation that they
that's
saw.
That's so funny. Just this morning, I had made no connection until right now. Just this morning, I heard the Ayelet Shaked, Knesset member Ayelet Shaked, former justice minister, talking about how foreign workers should not be given a pension. Why? Because they get a lot more money than they do in their other countries. But this system in which we are promising a pension for foreign workers is bankrupting the people who use them. And so these foreign workers are basically, it's an impossible situation that employers find themselves in. But it's the same thing, which is like you're buying it, you're getting a worker, but you're getting a master.
Yeah, listen,
under bad laws.
There's a lot of tension there, and but the point that I was driving at is that the weakest of society here, there's an institution which I'm not advocating for indentured servitude, but there's an institution which is meant to ensure that they stay within Am Yisrael and survive.
Right.
And by the by, as the verses say, that when this slave goes free, mm-hmm. right, so too says, v'im kapo yavo b'kapo yetze. If he came empty-handed, he leaves empty-handed. Im al ishahu v'yatza ishto imo. And if he was married, his wife goes out with him. So the Midrash asks, and Rashi brings, what, his wife? What, who mentioned his wife? You enslaved this guy. You didn't enslave his wife. So the answer to that is that if I have a Hebrew servant, I'm responsible for supporting his wife and children as well.
Right.
So what you see is there's a way in which this is a social insurance policy. Again, in the 21st century, we have other ways of doing such a thing. But don't undervalue the level of concern that the Torah is expressing for the integrity of Am Yisrael.
Right, right. I mean, when you go to a supermarket and you see a mentally handicapped person working there, you feel good. Because you're like, wow, these guys hired this person, and that means, and I'm going to be nice to him, and we're all going to be nice to him because our society wants to make sure that this person isn't broken, isn't out of the picture completely.
This is one of the parshiot you actually see the truth of that old saying that you know a society by the way it treats its most vulnerable.
Mm-hmm. And that is a big topic in this parsha. We'll get to that in just a little bit. Let's go to the next thing, which is there's a kind of a servant who doesn't want to leave. He wants to be. He wants to continue to be. He feels that that's his lot in life.
And sometimes it's good. I mean, he's being totally taken care of. Right. If he's got a master who's kind to him, he's well insured.
Right. But the Torah provides for that. But it seems to not quite like that. I mean, to say it happens. But then you have to take his ear to the doorpost and kind of put an earring in.
And you put an awl right through there.
Right. You basically nail it through.
Right.
And the rabbis say, you know, this ear that was meant to hear the call of freedom at Mount Sinai wanted to become enslaved. There's something kind of wrong with that.
Because you become a servant to a servant.
Servant to a servant, but and you're not just supposed to be a servant. You're also not supposed to go in that general direction.
Well, you're a servant of God, not a servant to God.
Right, but not servant of man. Right, right. You got freedom from man. We talked about it last week from servitude to service. Right, that was the tagline last week, but. This week we talk about, you know, this guy's doing something a little bit wrong. Interestingly, I found that there was a medrash that said that this is actually talking about Moshe Rabbeinu saying, I love my master, that's God, my wife, that's Torah, and my children, that's the children of Israel. I don't want to be free. I don't want to be separated from them. But God said to him, don't speak to me anymore about this. So do not ask repeatedly. So you can't ask what the servant asked in this case, which is, I want to stay and be a servant. Had God not blocked him from that, he would have
gone into the land of Israel with them.
Exactly. Okay, fine. So then, so that's that kind of servant. Let's keep going. Let's talk about for a second about a few verses down. We're in chapter 21 of the book of Exodus. Let's talk about hitting your parents. Hitting your parents. So here's an interesting thing. It says,
I'm laughing because I told my son that we couldn't go out for paintball because it might be a violation of a Torah level prohibition.
Okay, let's say your son became a dentist and you needed some dental work. So can you go to him? The answer is a preference not.
Preference not, yeah, for sure.
Preference not.
Because he's going to draw blood.
So the Torah says to you these things. By the way, I've said this on the show before, but I want to say this again. I tell my kids about these mitzvot, these commandments, and then I say to them very carefully, don't think that I am demanding this of you. I, too, am demanded this very thing of my mom that you see me dealing with all the time. So just understand that, like...
This is why I never became a dentist.
but I want to make that point to them, that I don't want them to think that I...
Yeah, you're just using the Torah to get one over on them.
I'm like, no. Just watch the way I do it for my mom and understand that we're talking about a chain.
Listen, it's a huge advantage of a multi-generational family life. Right. And it's obviously the way which the Torah conceived things should be, because that was the way the world was up until relatively recently.
So check this out. So I have a book in front of me today called Mimayanot HaNetzach, From the Wellsprings of Eternity. And this is a compilation of Hasidic statements from various rabbis on verses. I find it for this Torah portion to be just totally key and helpful. It's got all these little phrases. For example, it says that Elimelech of Lizhensk used to say about himself that he did tshuva he repented for any time that when he was a little boy, like a 4-year-old, and played with his parents and may have hit them. He did tshuva for that, and he did tshuva for being in any way injurious to his mother in the womb.
Oh.
Okay, as in, I'm commanded not to draw blood. I'm commanded not to injure you. So I've done a kind of sin by being naughty in the womb.
I'm just thinking of the level of roughhousing that happens in my house.
Right.
And now my wife hates it, that as soon as the three of us, me and the two boys, get near each other, it's just like, quack, quack, quack.
So, but isn't that an interesting thought? And he did say it's wrong that I was born or anything like that. No, we didn't say that. But he did tshuva for that element in
life
his
life. Life is
messy,
man. Life is messy.
That's right. And then you're born, right?
Right.
Two men are fighting, and guess what? They bump into a pregnant lady, and the baby comes out. If the baby did not get hurt, if the baby dies there.
No.
If a man strikes a slave.
No, it's
male
not
or
talking
female.
About the baby there. That is a huge difference between the Masoretic text and the Septuagint. It leads to a serious split
right.
in today's world toward the question of abortion.
Mm-hmm.
The verse that we're looking at is, I'm
talking about 21, 22.
Here we go. Let me just get my eye on it. Right? Like, two people are struggling and they shove this pregnant woman, and her child comes out, and there's no disaster.
Right.
So the question is, no disaster to who? To her or to the child? So Rashi says clearly in the footsteps of the sages, no disaster to her.
Mm-hmm.
Right? Anoshi Anesh, right? Then you're going to punish according to the... Why is that so important? Because if it was the question of whether the child lived or died, then we would have a very different stance on whether a child in utero is a life. And this is the source in the Torah for the notion that a child in utero is not a life. Now, that doesn't necessarily mean that abortion is completely permitted in all situations, etc. That's a widespread debate within Jewish law. But it's just critical to note here is that the question of the disaster that's happening here is the woman, not the child.
Mm-hmm.
The child is a question of monetary law in this equation. The woman is the question of whether it's just monetary law or it's a matter of life and death.
Uh-huh. That is very interesting. But there is no fatality with the woman.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
He shall surely be punished to pay the value of the fetus to the husband.
Notice, value of the fetus.
Mm-hmm.
Because, and that's what Rashi explains, is that because we're in the laws of slavery, and also this is how you try to get a value there, that if a pregnant woman had been sold in the marketplace, you're going to pay a certain amount for her knowing that she's about to give birth. If she's not pregnant, you'll pay less.
Mm-hmm.
And so that's how we sort of calculate the value of the fetus. But my point is that it's a question of monetary law, not
capital punishment. Very good. Okay. And then immediately after that, it says the famous verse, Ein tachat ein, eye for an eye, Shen tachat shen, a tooth for a tooth, Yad tachat yad, hand for a hand, Regel tachat regel, a foot under a foot or foot for a foot. Kviyat tachat kviyat, burn for a burn, petza tachat petza, an injury, a wound for a wound, chabura tachat chabura,
a bruise for bruise,
right? So we understand that to mean, and you can understand how the rabbis get to this, which is this means monetary recompense, and you can understand that because it doesn't say anywhere to lash or anything like that. It doesn't say to hit or to do things. Right, it says the verse that's attached to it says you have to exact payment based on the reckoning.
You know, this is known in non-Jewish law as lex talanis, right? And it's one of those things where
what's the word? I love these Latin
lex
words.
I think it's lex talanis. You should probably Google that in case I'm being wrong in the middle of our show. But
okay.
I'm pretty sure I'm right. But and it's one of the parallels that people like to draw between this and the Code of Hammurabi. Because it also has the same notion. And what you've said is very true, that it's the sages who teach us that this is not meant to be taken In the sense of poking another person's eye out.
But I don't think the text says that.
Well, that's exactly the point I'm driving at. Yeah. You know, the old joke that without the oral law, we'd all be blind and toothless.
Right.
Right. So the reality is it's not just this is not the sages with a sort of a later morality softening what they see to be the sort of harsh ancient Near East. No, they're dealing with a real question. They assume that the Torah wants justice.
Right.
And justice means that you pay what you have damaged. Now, there is no way of gaining equivalency between the pain of your loss of eye and the pain of my loss of eye. Not only because it's a subjective pain, but like what if you're a sharpshooter and I don't know, I farm cucumbers. Like the loss of my eye is a far less than the loss of yours. So therefore, what they say is the only way to do that is through monetary estimation.
Mm-hmm.
So it must be the actual intention of the Torah and not some sort of projection of a later morality upon right. sort of the harsh Old Testament, as certain traditions like to say.
And I want to add here that my father, Alav Shalom, said something to me that last week I actually found in the Baal Turim said straight out. He said, look, what it really means is if you don't judge in this lower world in monetary, I will judge in the upper courts in karma. I will judge it as an eye for an eye. I mean, so if you take monetary value for the eye that's lost, if you make justice in this lower world, good, then justice is served. If you didn't do that, then like it says in Pirkei Avot, you drown somebody, you yourself were drowned. Okay. Speaking of getting hurt, there's also getting healed. Just a few verses beforehand, it says if the guy that got hurt, we're not going to get into that case, but if he walked, the servant, I think, if he walked again, all you have to do is pay for his idleness and his cure. Verapo yirapeh. The rabbis understand that this is the place that teaches us that doctors are allowed to heal.
Yeah.
Doctors are allowed to heal. That's very obvious in our very modern, postmodern world. But I know that even not so long ago, and even in some sects around the world, healing is like, wait a minute, you got punished, you got hurt? That's from God. God will heal you, and that's it.
And it's not just on that level. It consistently, in modern literature, art, etc., arrogant doctor... is a cultural trope,
right?
Because there's an understanding that like the Gemara says, the Tova Rofim Legehenim, right? The best of doctors is still going to hell. Why? Not because they're helping people, because they think it's them. They think it's about right. them. Because on some level, like, you look at a surgeon who, I mean, I just had this knee surgery, which is a minor surgery, but it's a little bit astounding to me. This guy, he's just smiling and happy. He's ready to open up my knee and start clipping away at the inside because he's looking at a video screen. It's an astounding level of right. self-confidence you have right. to have. Imagine what a brain surgeon is like, you know? Right. And that self-confidence grades into arrogance very easily. And of mm-hmm. course, you know, once you're filled with arrogance, there's not much place for God.
Mm-hmm. And I found here that in my book, the Gemara says, "Mikan shenitna reshut lerofe lerapot." From here, we learned that the doctor is allowed to heal, and the Gra, where was it? Where was it? He said, "That's right." Oh, so the Gra, his sister, the Gaon Mevilna, his sister's son was very ill, and he said, "You have to trust in Hashem." And she said, "But the doctor said he's going to die," and he said, "They have no right to say that. What they have a right from the Torah is rapo yirapeh. You're allowed to heal."
You can't pronounce, right?
You can heal. You're not allowed to pronounce.
Give a prognosis
of right. death. That's just not that's, within your purview.
That's interesting,
right? It's purple. You're a ped. That's what you're allowed to do. That's it. That's your purview.
That's an interesting ethical question for a religious doctor.
I find that most people get very annoyed when doctors give them a time frame. People don't like that. But today they really try not to do that. I think mostly. And one of the listeners to this show, by the way, my good friend Dr. Brodsky, who recently is in the land of Israel
right.
on an Aliyah kind of test.
I met him.
Yeah, he's great.
Came to my dad's Russia share.
That's right. That's awesome. And he says that he told me once that he, you know, sometimes he said to me, "Well, he's a heart doctor."
Mm-hmm.
He says, "I got it all under control. I got all the right meds, the right docs, the right nurses, I got the right things." And we still lose a patient. And sometimes we don't have everything all together. And it's like, and sometimes a person comes out and he said, "Sometimes I feel I'm in a tug of war with the angel of death."
Mm.
And that I'm trying to tug, and sometimes I win, and I try to tug, and sometimes he wins. But that's very Jewish. that's very Jewish. Like, my job is to tug away from the angel of death.
That's right. We fight for life.
That's right. That's a Jewish thing. You
don't
know
always
I mean?
Win, but you always fight.
Right. You always fight. That's and some of the greatest Jewish philosophers and Jewish religious men. Best examples, of course, the Rambam and also Ramban. But the Rambam famously is a doctor.
Almost every single one of them in the European world.
Right.
It was just a natural fit.
Right. But not Rashi. He was a winemaker.
He was a vintner. Well, yeah.
That also heals, right?
I was going to say, I'm sure that Rashi could do his fair bit of healing.
Rashi's the best. Okay, let's go on. So, Rabbi Mike Foyer, we talked about the weak members of society before. We talked about the servants, the indentured servitude. There's also a large amount of discourse here about the widow, the orphan,
and the stranger.
And the stranger, the convert.
Well,
it could be a convert or a sojourner,
well,
right?
Well, this line here, if I'm correct, what you're thinking of in chapter 22, line 20.
Right.
That you'll see here that the plain meaning of the word ger, even though we use it today as convert, in fact, according to our sages, most of the places it's used in the halachic language, it means convert. Here, it actually doesn't work. Because if it was convert, you should not oppress the convert because you were converts in Egypt.
No, you were strangers. Right.
Yes.
Right.
And that's why Rashi is almost forced to say that truth is that the meaning of ger, he says, right? Where is it here? Here it is. Adam shalom nolad be'oto medina. A ger, right? Kol lashon ger, everywhere the word ger appears, it means someone who wasn't born in that particular town or country. Ela ba medina acheret lagur sham. Rather, they came from somewhere else to live here.
Right.
So, by the way, this is not a small sort of linguistic distinction because it's a big question in terms of where our responsibility. The Torah says repeatedly, some people say, I think 36 times, that one should not oppress the ger.
Right.
Most of the usages are referring to
the stranger.
A convert.
Oh, a convert.
Wait,
okay.
Like the halachic imperatives.
A person who became a Jew.
Yes. And then there's a question of why there needs to be a special sort of dispensation.
Right. And I learned this with the kids yesterday. You're not supposed to really remind a convert that he's a convert. You're not supposed to remind him of that. And you're not supposed to like make a thing of that. He wants to be inside the people. But in here, we're talking about the stranger who's coming from a different place.
And is therefore vulnerable.
And he's vulnerable. That was the word my kids were like, vulnerable? Like that.
Have you tried to get them to say Massachusetts? That is the test to see if your children have gained English fluency.
Okay, I'll check
that. I have
one
child who can say Massachusetts.
Okay, I'll check that tonight. But they were like, vulnerable?
What is vulnerable.
What is vulnerable? What is that? And we were talking about what vulnerability means, that whole issue.
How would you say vulnerable in Hebrew?
So yesterday I said to them, adin, pagia.
Pagia
is like somebody who can be easily injured or
pagia, I think is probably what I would go for.
But chalashim b'chevra, that's what you would say. Weak.
But notice, I'm looking for the word. It says a lot whether there is a word or not.
Right. So the Torah here lays out, instead of a word, it lays out the kind of people that you can understand. That are like that, and so it's, and they're going to lump in the almana, the and the yitom, the orphan. So I saw here in the book that I'm the compendium of today of the Hasidic statements. There's this story about Rabbi Yisrael Misalant, who's not Hasidic.
I would say in a book of Hasidus.
Right, it's not just Hasidic.
I don't know if he would be happy being in a book of Hasidus.
That's right. but this book brings in the Gra and the Hasidic.
The Gra for sure wouldn't be happy.
Right, and it brings in the Musar movement folks. But still, he's baking some matzah. And so the other students ask him, how do you make the matzah kosher, mehadrin, what do you call it?
Best of the best.
What do we call the matzah? We call matzah shmura. I didn't make it really shmura matzah. He said, you got to make sure you see that lady. She is an almanat. See the lady who's rolling the dough there? She is a widow. Yeah. You got to be nice to her. And if you're not going to be nice to her, it's not going to be matzah shmura. Okay? That's what he said to her. And he said to them, because you don't know how important it is, the issue of making sure not to oppress the weak members of society. By the member of society is an oleh. A person who's come to the land of Israel, even from America.
Even from America, that's right.
You know what I mean? People that come here to the land are strangers. I'll never forget this. I'm ashamed to tell the story, but like what happened was I was a, I just made it to a new town in the land of Israel, and I just called the nurse and it late at night because there was some serious problem for the first time. And her husband picked up the phone and he's like, "You know perfectly well not to call us, blah, 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 blah." I'm like, "Sir, I just got here today. You know what I mean? I got a problem and I don't know who to turn to. And that's why I'm calling you today. Don't yell at me. You know, like, don't be careful because you don't know who you're dealing with. Sometimes somebody's a weak member of society. Have that gentleness."
Yeah.
You know, also in driving, the person who's in front of you and you're honking because they're going, you know, 25 and an 80. I don't know what, you know, and like be careful.
Or only 80 and an 80.
Right. Because that person may very well be an orphan. That person may be a stranger. A lot of times when you're driving in a new road down in a town that you're not usually in. So people are honking you because you don't know where to turn.
Right.
Exactly. And you just want to turn around and say, "Hey, I'm not from here. I remember I was once pulled over by the police in Florida. I know exactly where. And I was like, I didn't know that there was, like, this was in the days before Waze. I didn't understand that there was a turn and then another turn exactly. So I was in the wrong lane and I
got a ticket for that over in,
you know what I mean? I didn't make the turn. You know what I'm saying? I didn't make the turn. I kept going in a turning
straight,
lane.
Yep.
And she pulled me over. I mean, down in Florida, she had the lights on me. I thought she was going to shoot me.
Right.
I was like, "Lady,
you're happy you're white."
I'm just a Jewish guy. She happened to be black, and in any case, it wasn't a racial thing. It was like a Florida thing.
Yeah, it was like
they were going to
sell.
Right, exactly.
We're in a forward position here.
She had the light onto my car like I was some kind of criminal. I'm like, I'm just a Jew boy from Israel here, okay?
Just made a wrong turn. Or failed to make a right turn.
Anyway, so what were you going to say something?
Nah, that's it.
Okay, Peseder. So fine. So be careful with the weak. Be careful with the weak in your society. Okay, let's just deal quickly with loaning money. This is the...
I'm more than happy to receive.
Right. So it says, "Im kesef talve et ami, et ani imach," which means if you lend money to my people, to the poor amongst you.
Mm-hmm.
And the im here is considered the only im.
One of four,
is that it?
Yeah.
Oh, really? Because look at the Mechilta says, I found the Mechilta says, "Kol im shebatorah reshut chutz mizeh." Maybe it has other list of four. Chovahi velo reshut. This im, in any case, this im certainly doesn't mean.
Actually, Rabbi Shmuel says chutz mishalosh. Rashi brings it, says, "Kol im ve'im betorah reshut chutz mishalosh."
Okay.
V'zeh echad mehem.
Okay.
Right? Except three of them, this is one.
Uh-huh. Anyway, the Mechilta says a little different. Doesn't matter. The bottom line, this im, which usually means if. This means like when.
It's not a contingent statement.
Right. Like when you loan money.
And it's important that people know that it is a separate mitzvah,
right,
to loan money to those who are in need without interest.
Without interest, that's right.
I mean, tzedakah, giving tzedakah is its own mitzvah. It's a beautiful thing. But if you want to fulfill all 613 mitzvah, you should always make sure that you give money, you loan money to someone,
right,
and don't expect interest.
That's right. And they have in our beloved Israel and also in Jewish societies around the world, free loan societies. And I knew Professor Jaffe, Alav HaShalom, here in Jerusalem, who had started, and I had interviewed him two or three times.
We've spoken about him before.
Right.
And you know that their organization is right next door here.
Is it? I would
like
to visit them.
They renamed called Ogen, which is a terrible branding move.
Ogen means anchor.
Right, means anchor. But you look at that, you're like, I don't know what that means. Right. Israel Free Loans Association.
Yeah, Israel Free Loans Association.
I knew exactly what that meant.
Right, exactly. Yeah, exactly. So
classic bad move.
Marketing is a really tricky business. They should have called it Haagen-Dazs, and that would have made it. Okay?
And people have been lining up.
You know what? You know that Haagen-Dazs doesn't mean anything?
No?
It's not. They literally made it up.
Okay.
No, but like you have to be brilliant to do that.
What does Farfenugen mean?
That means the feeling that you get when you drive a Volkswagen. Farfenugen. It depends also which era, because there was a different Farfenugen in the 40s.
Yeah, well,
and it's just an old different.
It was a different feeling of Volkswagen.
You're in Auschwitz.
And
you're like
no
Farfenugen.
No Auschwitz jokes. No Auschwitz jokes. Sorry. Poorly ventilated vehicles. Okay, can we cut that part out?
Okay, no. Remind me later. Anyway, Farfenugen, name of the show this week. I remember Professor Jaffe told me that they started, I think it was with $40,000, and then at some point it was like 100 million shekel, like $30 million of recyclable money. Oh, and people would just, well, how did that happen? Because people kept saying, I want to donate some money, a grant, for you to use within this free loan society. And he was an economics master, this Professor Jaffe, and he was an old man by the time I spoke to him. But he really like understood the whole system, and he was a religious economist, and just was able to. That mitzvah is a.
This is a classic case of being mezakeh et harabim.
Right.
He brought tremendous merit not just to the people obviously receiving the loans. He wasn't bringing them merit. He was actually helping them in a practical sense. But he gave tremendous merit to those of us who were able to give him money because it's a separate mitzvah. It's a special one.
That's right. Okay, one of my favorite mitzvot in the whole Torah is found in this week's Torah portion because.
Which one? I don't want. We should actually not say. We'll have people write in and think. What do you think Yishai's favorite mitzvah is? Or at least hit pause right now and choose.
Think for a second. But I will tell you this: there is little written about it, and it's not one of the most beloved commandments in the Jewish pantheon. What do we call it? Decalogue.
We don't call it a Jewish pantheon.
Oh, no. What's the word I'm looking for? Like the codex.
Corpus of Jewish law.
It's not often discussed.
My wheelhouse is definitely spinning. All right, what do you got?
This is one of my favorite commandments. It's 22, verse 27. It says, "You shall not revile a judge nor curse upon a chieftain amongst your people."
One.
Right?
I think I knew this.
You're not supposed to curse your leaders.
Oy, Am Yisrael.
It's just not a beloved commandment. You know what I mean? We like to go the other way. And I've never really bumped into a Gemara that talks about this one. I haven't. It's just not often discussed.
It's like swept under the rug a little bit there.
You're not supposed to curse your leaders. What do you want us to do here?
You met the Jews?
How am I going to sell a newspaper around here?
Right,
you know what
exactly.
I mean? But it is true.
What would you do on Twitter?
It's true. And by the way, I think that this should be read, the leader that you like, you shouldn't curse, but the other guy... You could like BB, he's all right, but Gantz, yeah, he's the or the other way,
Or there, of course.
All right, like BB, we gotta get rid of BB. He's he's done this, that, or the other. By the way, I saw two times on Twitter yesterday. The BB channel went live.
BB channel. The fact that there's a BB channel just says something wrong with the universe.
It's a weird thing, but I really Twitter has a lot of live stuff, and it's very easy to watch. It's just a good technology. I think because I don't like Facebook. I'm one of the weird people. I've never liked Facebook, even though the Kodesh Baruch Hu has blessed me with some followers there, but I just don't love that interface. It's just, but Twitter I always liked. Anyway, yesterday I saw BB twice. Okay, and first he was speaking to Russian Jews, and then he was on Channel 20, and I was like looking at him, and I was like, why do you look so chipper? Why do you look so young, chipper, and vibrant? Aren't you like reviled by a third of the country?
The fact that they just fixed a date for his
right. Don't they want to
his court date 2 weeks after the election?
Don't they have a tree hanging for you, waiting for you to hang somewhere? Aren't they gunning for you? And isn't like aren't you in a third election cycle?
Which by the way, according to the polls,
is not so great.
Going
to
produce the exact. Same thing.
So how is it that you and aren't you like a prime minister of a really cantankerous people?
That one's for sure.
Like, I don't get it because you're not supposed to look this chill. He just looks so just in control and in a good mood. His face didn't have lines. His eyes weren't red. I'm like, why do I look tireder than you, dude? What is that?
You don't have the kind of cash to put into how you look.
He goes. You know, and they asked him that. And he goes, I sleep every night. I sleep 6-7 hours every night. That's what he says. He goes, the red phone wakes me up, but I go back to sleep. That's what he says. Yeah. Shoot him. Don't shoot him. Yeah. Whatever it is. And
what do I care?
And I was just
like, ice cream? Yeah, you can get us ice cream.
Yeah, exactly. No, they don't wake him up for that. But the point is that you know what? Don't be careful. Be careful. Do not curse your leaders.
I was treading on the edge of a Torah level prohibition.
That's what
there.
I'm saying.
That is the truth.
It's not a beloved prohibition of the Jewish people.
It's so much fun, though.
Exactly. And yet, you're really not supposed to curse a judge and a curse amongst and.
No, listen, all joking aside, I think this is actually critical. We see right now, both in America with President Trump and here with Prime Minister Netanyahu, be careful, sort of like taking out one's personal. Or even political ideological differences, because what you end up doing is undermining the structure that holds us all together.
That's right.
And here we haven't
tearing that speech was
exactly.
To me
we
that
haven't quite
was like,
reached
wait.
That point, but I fear for the American Republic, yeah. the level at which the institution of the presidency has become eroded
yeah.
by everybody's behavior. And your example of Speaker Pelosi tearing up the speech is like a like that was kind of the last straw for many people.
I thought to me it was like, wow, that's forget Trump, forget him. That's like the institution of the yeah. State of the Union and et cetera. Any case, it wasn't a beautiful thing. But here in Israel, we do it as well. And interestingly enough, just a few verses later, it says very beautifully. It says you shall not put. You shall give me the firstborn among your sons. You shall do the same with your cattle and your flocks. Seven days, I'm reading from a small text here. 7 days it shall remain with its mother. On the eighth day she'll give it to me. Okay? Now we switched the firstborns for the
dead of Egypt.
Right, but and at the end they became the Kohanim, right?
The Levites took their place in the divine service, yeah. Right. And that's why you have a Kohen do your Pidyon Ben, redemption of the firstborn.
Redemption of the firstborn. I was a firstborn. You're not.
I am not.
Right. And then it says very interestingly, Ve'anshe Kodesh Tiuli. Mm-hmm. Be to me a holy people. And along with that, and meat that is flesh torn by the beasts of the field, you shall cast it to the dogs. Be a holy people unto me. Don't eat meat that's like on the floor.
Right. And it's such a powerful expression of the Torah's perspective on holiness in general, and Parsha Mishpatim in particular, because you know we have a tendency at least in English, and I think in a lot of Western culture, to think of holiness in very grandiose terms,
right?
Right, sort of very like in Shabbat was a good example from last week, very heavenly, societal, structural, you know, grand terms. Here's like, be a holy people. Don't eat meat that's dead in the fields.
Right.
Like, well, what's the Havamina? Like, why would I eat dead meat? And the answer is, well, people do all kinds of things. And your animal response to potential food, something which is desirable,
right,
is the place to test whether you're truly committed to that relationship of sanctity. Mm-hmm. You know, like something as simple as if you keep kosher and you go out to eat with friends in a non-kosher restaurant, and I've had this experience many times, and you know, like, oh, let's just have a glass of water or maybe a beer or something, you know, it's fine. But people will say to me, like, oh, how could you not eat this? Like, they're eating all these, you know, fancy meals and this. And my answer is they say, don't you, like, is it just, like, does it look gross to you? I'm like, no, actually, it looks quite tasty. But what am I supposed to do? Like, that's not who I am.
Right.
The demand of holiness in this moment is to simply say no.
Right.
And the demand of holiness might be the court that you serve in, or it might be the type of clothing you wear, or it might be, you know, who you marry, whatever it is. But that holiness is a daily lived practice.
Right. And if I eat in that, I'm going to also injure another deep yearning, deeper yearning, deepest yearning, and that is to be close to God.
Yeah.
If I eat this, I'm somehow tainted. I'm somehow lowered. I'm somehow cannot stand at that height that I was before. I'm somehow become somewhat repugnant to God. There's something about it which is base, which is low, which is like the animals that are in the field, right? Like you are the flesh in the field.
Well, I think there's that.
You are what you eat.
Yeah, and I think there's definitely the implication in this verse, which is give it to the dog.
Right.
It's like, you know, you
and the dog is a beloved creature.
He's a beloved creature. Rashi even says, right. Why the dog here? Because it didn't bark when we came out from Egypt. God doesn't hold back the reward from any creature.
Right.
Nevertheless.
But you're not a dog.
Exactly.
Right. You're not a dog. Don't be a dog. There's a difference between you and the dog. And that's what it means. Anshei Kodesh. It's you got to be people. But holy, a holy people.
Holy people.
Holy people. That's an awesome. That verse itself is awesome teaching verse.
It's a good one.
For like what the heart of Judaism is.
Yeah, and it's a big challenge for the elements of Judaism that don't see the connection to God through law.
Mm-hmm. I want everybody to that's exactly right. And I want everybody to please, when you get a chance, open up verse Exodus verse 22, Shmot Chavbet verse 30, verse Lamed. I want you just to look at it. I want you to look at it and think about it. V'anshe kodesh tiuli, be for me a holy people. U'basa basadet trefa, a flesh that's laying in the field, the dead flesh in the field. Lo tochlu. Lo tochelu, excuse me. L'kelev tashlichun oto. Don't, do not eat it. Send it out to the dog. I want you just to think about that. Really, the difference between, and that, if you think about it, in that, there are actually four characters in that phrase. The Jewish person. There's five characters. Look at this. There's the Jewish person. There's me, God. Mm-hmm. There's the flesh in the field. Mm-hmm. And then there's the dog.
Right.
And then there's the field. Excuse me, the field itself. That's the fifth. There's a field. And there's all these like objects in this, in this thing. Like, you've got to raise yourself up from field to dead animal to dog to be human beings to serve me. Okay, it's an incredible verse there, and I think it'll teach us a lot. Let's talk for a second about the donkey that your like enemy, that your Jewish enemy is
the enemy donkey.
The enemy donkey, but it doesn't mean your the donkey's actual not the enemy. No, it doesn't mean your actual enemy. It means you're like
your fellow Jew that you don't like.
Right. The guy that the shul that you don't go to. You know, the guy that you,
when the donkey wanders out of the shul you don't go to.
That's right.
You must bring him home.
And let's say you see when you see the donkey of your enemy lying under its burden and has a hard time getting up, you have to raise that donkey up. You have to help the donkey with that load. Do not use the bad word for donkey.
You saw me bite my lips.
That's right. Do not.
Such a bad line just came into my head. Bad.
No,
mic.
No, no. Okay.
Bad mic, but it was funny. I want you to know it was funny.
I'm sure it was, and they would have laughed, and I'm sorry that
and you would have to erase it.
That's right,
show.
And I'm sorry that I had to be an Anshei Kodesh, okay?
I just got chastised.
Wait, so tell me about helping out a fellow with a load that he can't carry.
On some level, this follows through from a bit of the morality that we saw in this line of Anshei Kodesh, Yuli, right?
Right.
That the natural instinct when you see someone you don't like in a bad situation is to go, "Who sucks to be you?" and right. walk away.
There is a German word for that.
Yeah, Schadenfreude.
Schadenfreude, was it?
Something like that, yeah. The joy you take in seeing someone else's difficulties. I learned that word, by the way, when there was the French Intifada back in like 2002 or 2000, I think it was 2002.
Right.
Right, when they were like rioting in the cities of France, and I was here during the second Intifada. I was like, oh, that must be very difficult for you. Can you look back at your press coverage of the last year? Anyway, that's when I learned the word.
That's right.
So anyway, meanwhile, here is I think there is a, I don't know if it's natural, but it's an understandable social response. And the Torah says, no. You do what's right because it's right.
Mm-hmm.
And Davka, the person that you don't like, is the one that you need to train yourself to help in this situation.
Right. Right. Have compassion.
Actually, I don't know that it's meant to be compassion. Mm-hmm. Maybe ideally you're supposed to get the compassion,
mm-hmm.
but sometimes have compassion is an insufficient answer, because what if I don't have compassion? Do what's right because it's right, and maybe good. That will train you to be compassionate.
I want to tell you something, Rabbi Mike. I have been working on a characteristic trait of mine recently. I'm not joking. I've been working on a thing inside. I started realizing that I wasn't judging people favorably. The little things.
That's where they get you. Yeah.
The little things. And I was like, oh, this guy doesn't want to write me back on WhatsApp. It's because he's, you know, he's a jerk. You know? And I started really working on this. Like, he's just busy. I use my lawyer mind. Like,
I was going to say, it's helpful to tell people how you're doing that work.
Yeah. I use a defense attorney in my head. I go, he's busy. He's doing a lot of great things. You know what? He's a really good person. He does great things for Am Yisrael. He happens to be really busy right now. Or maybe I made him feel uncomfortable or whatever it is. Or maybe something's going on in his life that I don't know about. And I'm just like, judge him favorably. The guy's not writing back to me. That's fine.
Can I just point out that there's a very important process you just laid out for people in general for their inner life? First of all, you have to notice. At some point, you came to self-awareness of what
yes.
you were doing.
Yes.
That's the first step. If you don't notice what's happening, you'll like get this whole emotional loop going and you'll never know.
Right.
Number one. Number two, you have to sort of distance yourself. Like, I notice, and that's not true. Let's put it this way. I don't know that it's true. Oh, this guy didn't write me back because he's a jerk. Is that true? I actually don't know.
Right.
And if I don't know for sure, then comes step number three, is I can substitute a more positive attitude.
Right.
The defense.
Right.
So that three-step processing, notice, questioning the absolutism of your judgments, and then substituting a positive response is a trio that will get you very far.
Right. There's maybe one more, which is, did you realize that thinking these bad thoughts about other people is bad for them, but it's really bad for you.
So ultimately,
your whole
that's the
inner
motivation.
Self is bitter.
Yes.
And what the motivation is complex because on the one hand, it's just a better thing for the world. It's also just, but like, why should I be? But there is a selfish aspect or a self-concerned aspect.
Yeah, it's not selfish.
Right. It's not selfish. It's actually the opposite of selfish. But it's right. like
why should you live with this poison?
Right, why should I live with this? Why should I keep thinking bad things? Absolutely. Let me think good things about people. And it's an active process at this point.
Yes.
So you have to actively think that.
For sure.
And
but you can rewire.
Right. It takes time and it begins to rewire, but you have to just
process
get used to it.
That I do a lot with people in counseling.
I cannot say how huge it is because it just changes your whole thingamabob. Your whole inner.
Your whole thingamabob.
The whole thingamabob changes inside because you start to feel like this is a good world and people are good.
Yes.
And also they don't owe me everything and I'm not at the center of their life. Et cetera, et cetera. It's a whole cascade.
Tell you a little trick too.
Yep.
I'd be willing to bet we don't have to go into your inner life right now. That we all see the world through the lens of ourselves.
Mm-hmm.
I wonder how much compassion and how much that defense lawyer is there for you when you think about yourself. You know, I think I'd be willing to bet that oftentimes we're judging yourself unfavorably in many situations as well. It's worth it to think about.
That is worth to think about it, and I hope that everybody listening, you know, takes a second to think to yourself, do you judge yourself harshly? Do you judge others harshly? Can you take one step towards, and that's what this donkey is about.
And if people want to work on it, I'll just do the shameless plug and they can write me an email at RoughMike@TheLandOfIsrael, or you can shoot me a message on Facebook. It's a process that can be really worked through and it can be a tremendous change in your life.
It's huge. It is humongous. And it just, I actually coupled it a little bit, it may sound funny, with a little bit less coffee, a lot less coffee in my life. All I meant to say is
take the edge off.
Yeah, that aggressive edge, a little bit more.
I find I'm a much nicer person when I have coffee myself.
But. Right, no, I understand that. I totally understand that.
I've experienced it, in fact.
I there is a few more things that I want to hit here, but there's one specific. Just before we get to that, the Torah suddenly shifts gear again and gives us laws of the land of Israel.
Yeah, it's a topsy-turvy structure here.
Yeah, it's a topsy-turvy structure, and I'm sure like Rav Soloveitchik, he'll like weave it all together. He does that kind of thing.
That.
But in this case, suddenly the Torah will say, okay, I gave you a lot of interpersonal laws between you and society.
Let's talk social structure.
Let's talk social structure. We're talking about the two things of the cycle, which is the 7-year cycle, the 7th year fallow, keeping the land fallow in the 7th year, the Sabbath of the land, and also the yearly cycle of the holidays, especially the 3 regalim, the 3 pilgrimage holidays, which you go up regalim. What a beautiful word, like walking, the walking holidays, the foot holidays, where you go up to Jerusalem, where you all actually, even if you live in Petah Tikva, you also make aliyah. The aliyah is to Jerusalem 3 times a year.
And if you're in Jerusalem, the aliyah is to
the Temple Mount. That's right. There's always an aliyah, a very important phrase. But then, at the very end of that discussion, where you would think would be a Sukkot, we'll talk about that maybe a different time, but where you would think it would talk about Sukkot, suddenly it says, Lo tevashel gdi b'chalev imo. Do not cook a kid in its mother's milk.
Dun, 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 dun.
It's like, what? Did you just say don't cook a kid in its mother? I didn't think about cooking a kid in my mother's milk.
Funny, it never occurred to me.
I never occurred to
do
me.
Do that.
And the Rambam says that he found himself old manuscripts of idolatrous manuscripts of pagan worship, and it said, yeah, cook a kid in its mother's milk.
It's the best.
It's the best. Or this is the right time for it. It might be that it's a certain time. But it, according to Rambam, it's a certain rite that we're not supposed to do. On the other hand, our sages teach us that we're not supposed to eat meat and milk, cook meat and milk, or enjoy a product
benefit
right. of meat and milk combo, as in selling a meat. I said to my kids yesterday, imagine if mommy made a, you know, steak with fluff, with you know, milchic fluff on top, you know, and sold it to and to the Arabs here
why
next
not
door.
Just go with cheeseburger?
I don't know. I was being creative. cheeseburger. Imagine if she sold the cheeseburgers here to the Arab village next door. That's illegal. Okay?
It's a real question. Can you work at McDonald's? Can you own stock in companies that deal in milk and meat? These are like real questions.
You know what? I actually did. My kids asked me that. What if you own a supermarket?
Ooh, they asked me that
yesterday, and I was like, I don't know. And then I was going to call Rabbi Shimshon, and I didn't have time. And I don't know. I don't know.
Meanwhile, you sold all your stock.
No, I think you do it. You do jointly with a Gentile, and
if it's something where you have direct decision-making power, like owning a supermarket, you've got a real problem there.
Right.
If it's a matter of owning stock, since even though nominally as a stockholder you have a voice, in reality you have no control, so it's considered enough of a distance from it. Because the same question when it comes to chametz, by the way. But I just want to point out that you said the sages teach that. It is critical to note to people that they teach that because it says this phrase
three times
in the Torah.
That's right.
Right? The prohibition against cooking, the prohibition against eating, prohibition against any benefit, which just begs the question.
Of the meat, milk
combo.
Now, I wanted to stop and discuss it with you a little bit more, so I'll ask for you for another 5 minutes on this.
Sure.
Because I don't know if people know how Jewish, how centrally Jewish the meat and milk thing is. How huge
depends on which people you're talking
to,
I guess.
It's definitional in the way
we
live.
Said, I don't know if people know. Yeah,
yeah, yeah. Like maybe like Christian folks and other folks, they might not understand what we mean, that we really have separate dishes. Separation. We have the two sinks. We have
Go further. You say we're going out to dinner tonight. Oh, is it a meat restaurant?
That's right.
Or a milk restaurant?
That's right.
Like, think about that for a second. In a non-kosher situation, there's no such thing as a
Let's explain that to people. I just want to make sure that everybody gets what we're talking about. If you ate a piece of meat, then you're not allowed to drink milk or eat cheese, etc., for at least, for most people, 5 hours.
Yeah, depending on your tradition.
Some people hold one, some people hold three. But most today in Israel hold
six. Where you got the five
into the sixth. Five and one.
Oh, we're going to argue about that later.
Yeah. In any case, there you go. That's fine. But many people, 6 hours, but certainly five into the sixth hour, whatever it is. And when you read the Talmud on it, it's like...
Mixa shakula? I'm sorry. I'm getting upset about this
it's
now.
Like, it doesn't seem in the Talmud that it wants you to have such a separation at first when you're like...
No, it's very clear what it says in the Talmud. It says it's Sura Achrita.
Right.
It's another meal. And
right.
What you get, the reason you have those types of divisions, is part of it is simply cultural. Like what really constitutes the next meal? Is it what's called Silek Ubirich? Like you just clear the table, make the bracha after the previous, and now there's the next meal.
Mm-hmm.
That's the technical issue.
Mm-hmm.
Or is it, no, like socially speaking, for most of history, people ate two meals. One in the morning, one in the evening. That's a 6 hour separation.
Mm-hmm.
You know, so suda achrita.
Okay. The bottom line is that just for lay folks, the bottom line is we have a humongous separation between meat and milk. This is a central facet of Jewish life.
Yeah, you know, it goes back to this idea of the laws which are commanded in order to shape life.
Right.
This is perhaps the quintessential one, like you're saying.
Right.
It's like this here, I'll shape your kitchen, I'll shape the rhythm. Meaning, I can't tell you how many conversations I had with my daughter. When she comes home, she's like, "What's for dinner?" And I'll tell her, "Oh, we're having chicken." She's like, "Okay, I'm gonna have coffee now." You know,
it's like
the whole rhythm of life revolves around it.
Rhythm of life revolves around it. So I was talking to kids about this stuff, and then I said to them, "Okay, but I have a good one for you about how to think about this." And they got excited. I said, "I really have a real good one. So pay attention. Lend me your ears." I said to them, I heard this from the Chabad sources, but I think it's out there. I saw it here in the book and a different source. Meat and milk are two opposite energies. I asked the kids. I said, what is milk? What does that represent? They're like, kindness, goodness. I'm like, why is that? It's motherly. It's mother's milk. Milk, it's a kindness. It's giving milk to a child. It's a sweetness. There's nothing...
warm milk before you go to sleep.
Right. But there's certainly nothing injurious in it. It's a white... Its color is...
And it's renewable.
It's
a renewable.
It's
resources.
Renewable. It comes back again, right? And it's just this motherly, good instinct of kindness. What is meat? Meat is death. Meat is red. Meat is harsh. Meat is judgment. Meat is
murder.
It's a type of murder. It's a killing, that's for sure. And those two energies cannot, they need to be separated out.
The two shall meet.
They don't coexist, these two energies. They're if you think about it, meat and milk are the opposite. When you have meat, you can no longer have the milk. Right?
Right.
If you
or the other.
Right. That's it. It's like it's really, they are not coexistent things.
That's interesting. Maybe that's why it's specifically phrased as the prohibition of a calf in its mother's milk, mm-hmm. because you might think you could have both, right? Because the calf produced them both. The mother produced them, but she produced a calf and she produced the milk. Yeah, you can combine them. See, they both come from the same place. The answer is no. That's a unique situation.
Oh, wow.
And therefore, we're going to phrase it in that unique situation to teach you actually how separate they ought be.
I like that very much.
That was well said.
That's great. That's great. I really like that a lot. And but by the way, in pagan societies, like in places like Africa, to this very day, you can milk a cow. Then you make a little scratch in the side of its body. You put the cup.
Blood.
You mix it with blood. You drink it. Okay, and those
a hearty mixture.
Right, a hearty protein shake. Right, but God says, "Don't do that. Do not drink the blood. Do not mix these."
That's a triple whammy.
Right, it's a triple whammy. Right,
that
happens.
That's blood, and it's part of a living animal.
But those societies, in the end, disappear off this planet because God does not. He does not. That is not.
Well, that in colonialism.
That in colonialism.
Sorry, I couldn't resist. You can't blame the end of tribal society on milking meat. Sorry, I'm not willing to go there.
I'll say to you that, what empowers the colonialism. But in any case, so the Lubao Cherebi adds one more interesting detail. He says, Chesed and Gvura are not, they cannot be homogenized in our time. He says, but in the time of the revelation, in the messianic period, they will be able to coexist. They will be able, and you will be able to have that cheeseburger.
Cheeseburgers in heaven?
Because, that's
cheeseburger
right.
in paradise?
Here on this world. Why? Because
you're not going to call the show Cheeseburger in Paradise?
Cheeseburger in Paradise? That's a good name for a show. That's good.
Trademarked. You might have a problem with it.
Why is it?
Oh, my gosh. What? Hashtag Cheeseburger in Paradise.
What are we
Thank
talking
you.
About here?
Nope. No. Hashtag Cheeseburger in Paradise.
It flew over my head. Wait, can I call it Cheeseburger in Paradise, or is that going to be a problem?
No, it's going to be a problem.
This is not a good thing?
I mean, it's a great thing, but it's trademarked.
Trademarks. Sue me. Anyway, so
that's the earlier part of the parsha.
Right. That's right. That's intellectual property, by the way, is a theme that I am interested in general. I actually read a intellectual property little legal booklet from time to time, just to
the halacha on it or just law.
The American law on it. It's just an interesting topic.
It's a big discussion on halacha as well.
Yeah, I'd like a book on that if you know one. If you know one,
think about.
A trademark and patent law, these things. Intellectual property, very interesting. Interesting, by the way, in Hebrew, intellectual property is called kinyan ruchani.
Yeah.
Spiritual
property.
Property. Is that interesting? Okay. I'm really glad we talked about meat and milk. Let's just finish off by saying that the end of the parsha says, I'm going to bring you into the land. Don't cut any deals with the people on the land. Don't sell it to anybody else. Don't sell it in perpetuity. The land is mine, right? Right. Don't allow them to stay in your land because they may cause you to go after them. You got to get rid of these seven nations. You got to get rid of them from the land. And certainly don't cut any deals with them. Very big concern about cutting any deals with them. And also at the same time,
even if it's the deal of the century.
Even if it's the deal of the century. That's right. By the way, I think I said to you last week, like I put up a picture, deal a century ago. That was a good deal, okay? A nice big land of Israel. But interestingly enough, it says, slowly, slowly shall I get rid of the nations from before you there. Slowly, slowly. Like,
lest the land be filled with Vildachias.
On the one hand, I don't know if the Vildachia one is, oh yeah, there it is, that's right. I won't get rid of them in 1 year because I don't want the land to be empty and the animals will, right, the wild animals, Vildachayas, will that's Yiddish, will kind of overcome you. Slowly but surely I'll get rid of them. I think what this means is, yes, there's miracles. Yes, I'm going to be with you. And yet, here's one of your favorite words, Rabbi Mike, there's process.
Yep.
There's process here. And even the political rebirth of the Jewish people in the land of Israel, like, it's awesome, it's huge, and yet it's
the process.
Right, it's still in process.
Yes.
So we are certainly in process.
In the thick of it, man.
All right, folks, you are listening to the Yishai Fleischer Show. Rabbi Mike Foyer joins me. Rabbi Mike can be found at his other show here, which is called The Jewish Story, also at his website, jewishstory.co. And also at Facebook, facebook.com/RevMike. And myself, Yishai at thelandofisrael.com. Oh, also RevMike at thelandofisrael.com. Or myself, Yishai at thelandofisrael.com. Or at YishaiFleischer.com. Or facebook.com/ Yishai Fleischer. Same thing on Twitter, et cetera, et cetera. Social media, we are there. We are found there. And we are definitely in the process of learning the Torah and understanding how it applies to us in the life, especially here in the reborn land of Israel. Rabbi Mike, I want to wish you a Shabbat Shalom.
Shabbat Shalom.
God bless you. Thank you so much for going with us through this heavy Torah portion of Mishpatim. A certain weight has been lifted off me because I was nervous to do this right today, so I hope that everybody enjoyed it. Everybody sent me a hashtag. What is it?
Cheeseburger
in paradise. I certainly do not know what that's
there was
a reference to.
Another one back there too. I forgot what else.
I don't remember.
Oh, day by day.
Day by day. Was that the one? Day by day. Yeah. That's a Broadway thing. I don't know anything about it. So let's see who can come up with the answers for that. And that's it. Malka Fleischer is up next, locked and loaded. She's got a lot of great stories for you today. Really, we have great stories. We've been
laughing that it didn't have to be a metaphor with
Malka. That's right. Malka locked and loaded next. Stay tuned. More great stuff is on the way. And thank you for joining us here from Yerushalayim, Yer HaKodesh. God bless you and Shabbat Shalom. We'll be right back. Rabbi Mike, thanks again.
Shalom.
One who doesn't respect and value his past is not worth the honor of the present and has no right to a future. Well, I promise you that I respect and value the past, and I, please God, would love to see honor in the present. And I know that all of us have a right to the future. I'm Rav Mike Foyer, and this is The Jewish Story.
Join Rav Mike Foyer for the best Jewish history podcast, The Jewish Story, on the Land of Israel Network at thelandofisrael.com.
All right, folks, we're back here on the Yishai Fleischer Show. This segment broadcasting from Judea, and that means that we are in the home of Malka Fleischer, our beloved. Shalom, Malka, how are you?
Hey, Yishai, how are you?
I am good. It's been a long day. It's been back to rain here in the land of Israel, which is...
Happy about it.
I am happy about it.
Being happy about it.
Yeah. Some people
still happy.
Some people, like in my family, suffer a little bit from like gray... Like
grayitis,
sun deprivation, depression, whatever it is, shtickle a little bit, but I'm okay with it as long as I know what weather is going to be. If I expect sun and it's going to be rain, then it could mess me up. But if I know like it's supposed to be rainy, I have a weird thing where like if I can prepare my mind for it, then I'm totally good with it.
Right. In the summertime, I'm always like, ugh, if only it would just rain.
Yeah.
And I'm like, I like winter. I like sweaters. I like the cold weather. I like the fall. I don't mind all the weather and stuff like that. But there have been like in the last like 2 weeks, there have been like 2 days of sun. And I've been enjoying those 2 days of sun. Yeah. Like I go outside. I don't know if you saw when you were a kid in like middle school or high school, there was like a period when they were showing, these like funny movies about like kind of like dystopian future. And there was this, I don't know, they did this in my school. I don't know what was going on at that time.
I didn't see dystopian movies in my school.
There was a few. There was a few like these little, I don't know. I think we were learning like books like 1984 and like things like that, books that were a little bit dystopian. So I remember one of the little movies we watched was about this like planet or something, this like situation in which the kids, like the sun only came out like one day every like year or so, maybe even less. And these kids were all at school. It was supposed to happen during that time. And then this one kid like got in a fight with some other kids and they like locked this kid in the room. And exactly then like the sun came out and the kid was going to miss like the one day of sun for the whole year. And I remember this vision of the kid like playing with this like one sunbeam, this like one beam of light coming into the room from the sun. So that is not exactly what we're going through here, basically. Just want to say that like the
what
few
kind of school
raised
did you go to like what's that about
public school in Sherman, Texas. Oh my God. But being out in the sun, I was like
Yeah.
And I'm a person who burns very easily, but I was just like, I'm getting all the sun I can.
I couldn't say this with Mike because he takes this stuff too seriously, the threat by Mike.
Yeah.
But I was thinking about making, like, it's been really raining a lot here in the land of Israel. We had many years of drought, and now we're having these years of, like, plenty. And I just wanted to make a sticker which said, global warming is good for me, or good to, or global warming has been good
to
me.
Nobody... really?
Do you think that'll be funny? Global warming's been good to me. You think?
Yeah, I don't know. Some people don't have a sense of humor about
that's what
stuff.
I'm saying. That's exactly what I'm saying. That's what I'm saying. Indeed, it's not a laughing matter, I guess, but it was a little bit funny. Anyway, speaking of the children.
Yeah.
This week,
We talking about the children?
Yeah, you spoke about these children who were
the kids
sun
with
rays.
The beam light. Yeah, that was a really. Yeah. As you can see, this dystopian reality, by the way, deeply affected me.
I never.
You are hearing me like I'm burning my soul about this one time that they made me watch this horrible.
Yeah, I never heard this thing.
Horrible story.
Yeah, I know.
That was very sad.
Wow.
I don't feel better having talked about it.
But it usually, you sometimes have to let the sun in.
Often. Yeah.
This week I drove out of town here and the kids of the town were all lined up on the street and all wearing like orange bands and the flag of Israel. And it was because there was a countrywide and certainly in our town and here in the Gush Etzion region, a area wide remembrance of the Gush Katif communities in Gaza, the Jewish communities in Gaza, which were evacuated or what's the other
word?
Expelled in 2005. And you and I were there. We were down there.
Right.
By the way, I still have a treasure trove of photographs.
Right.
If you remember, we had a little
Canon. I have a bag of sand.
And I remember we had a little Canon camera that we got. It was a refurbished little Canon camera.
Right.
And I had two batteries, and everywhere I went, it was like kind of slung on a pouch, and like I just took a lot of pictures. There's hundreds of pictures from Gush Katif.
Yeah,
hundreds of pictures, and very strong memory of that. And I had this internet card, which was like this rare thing at the time, and we would send out. That was the way
internet card?
It was like a USB that connected to the internet.
I don't remember that stuff.
That was the way we sent out stuff. That's how I sent the pictures.
Did you stick it in? It had its own machine?
No, we had an IBM laptop. We had the old IBM.
Oh, and it goes into the...
It was a USB card.
Oh, yes. The thing that gave you internet access.
Yeah.
And it was like a little tiny antenna stick.
Yeah.
Yeah.
When we were living in Gush Katif, we had no hot water.
No hot water. No refrigeration.
Oven, no refrigeration. And that's where we also met our good friends, the Brenners.
No furniture.
We came into a house which had been used for
paintball. I had to sweep it out.
Right, and
of sand.
And I remember the first time
paintball pieces.
There was just cold water. The house was not turned on.
Speaking of sun, not so bad given that Gush Katif was scalding, boiling hot.
It was
in the summertime / humid, which is like a Jewish girl's worst nightmare.
Frizzy hair.
You got the frizzy hair, and it's hot. You're schwitzing.
Schwitz. Yep.
So it's rough.
But what wouldn't you give back to? What wouldn't you give to Schwitz again?
Yeah, I would love to go
beloved,
Schwitz again.
Beautiful Gush Katif.
Gush Katif. One of the sunny days, few moments of sunny day this week was when the kids went out and did this Gush Katif remembrance thing. Now I didn't know that there was a Gush Katif day in the education system. I want to look into it a little bit and find out who got this done, because it's very interesting, right? It's like it was a government decision. It was a government policy decision to do this what they called at the time the unilateral disengagement, but what people like you and I called the expulsion from Gaza of the Jewish communities. And so because it was a policy, there must be a better word for this, but it was a government decision to go do this thing.
I think it was
the fact that they have now
ministry. It was probably an education.
The fact that they have now a Memorial Day, which is not meaning to say, what is the memorial for? It's not we did this thing and it was really great. It's like, we did this thing. It was really horrible. Here's what happened to the people. It was a bad decision. It was a bad decision on many levels. And like, we remember Gush Katif and we're going back there. Like, there were, you know, there are pictures of signs from the school that are like, Od Nachzor Lisham. And the old flag that used to be the kind of slogan and emblem of the time, which was Eretz Yisrael La'am Yisrael, the land of Israel for the people of Israel. And, you know, it was interesting, Yishai, because you and I didn't have kids when we went down to Gush Katif. Our oldest child is 12 years old, and the Gush Katif expulsion happened 15 years ago.
Mm-hmm.
So we were the kids. Basically, we were like kind of the kids who were protesting in Gush Katif. And in our naivete, we went down there thinking that we could, and in our like innocence, really, we went down there in the hope that we could prevent the expulsion. And there were a lot of like-minded people who came down too. And, you know, hindsight is 20/20. I think we could have done some things differently. But anyway, we couldn't really stop the momentum of this train that expelled the Jews from Gaza, and it was very, very painful.
Our own country doing
our
that.
Our own country. And it was like I was saying to others talking about this thing, it's really the closest that Israel came to a civil war in a long, long time, that the Jewish people came to really having it out between each other in a long time. That didn't happen, and I guess that's
it
for the best.
It happened on a mini level.
It happened on a,
at,
but it didn't
Amona.
Happen. It
at Amona, it went down. I was there.
I was also at Amona. We were at Amona together.
Were we at the at Amona? The
oh, that Amona.
No,
oh, that
yeah,
was
yeah,
that
yeah.
was horrible.
No, I don't think
that
you were
wasn't
there.
A
it was
civil
me.
War. That was the police attacking a bunch of protesters.
It was right after Gush Katif, and it was
that was
a
horrible.
Lot of people
I was
said,
not at Amona. I was at Kfar Maimon. I got confused.
Yeah. No. It was me and I don't. Yeah, me and Ezra Levy.
That was
we
terrible.
We were at Amona. It was a
and
terrible
you
thing.
And Brian. What's his name? Not Bebchik. I can't remember his name. Anyway.
But you know what?
The point is, I wanted to.
The kids, they were celebrating this thing.
So
they were remembering this thing.
So yeah. So what I wanted to say is, first, I decided that I'm going to go out to the street. A little announcement was sent out in town that the like all the school children of the town are going out to the street to do like a Gush Katif memorial, a link chain, like a holding hands. The technical chain linking didn't actually happen. But the kids did line up all along the street, and I decided I wanted to go out and see it. So I went out, and I walked down the street, and I saw these kids, and I got to tell you, Yishai, it threw me back 15 years, like for a few good minutes, to see these kids on the sides of the street wearing these orange like little wristband things and stuff that were the orange was the color of Gush Katif, and it was kind of the branding, I guess, because Gush Katif is a sunny place, like we talked about before. Speaking of the sun, it was so they used the orange sun and the orange bell peppers that they used to grow in the hothouses there. And for a second, it was like really emotional for me. For about 60 seconds, I really held back some like a big lump in my throat, seeing these kids on the street, because it really reminded me of like the optimism and the goodwill of tens and tens of thousands of young Jewish kids who did this all summer long, the summer that Gush Katif was expelled, in the hope that they could, you know, take their voice to the street and have it be heard and somehow stop this horrible plan from going down. And so seeing these like sweet kids, and they're cheering, and they're like Am Yisrael, and they're all positive, and they're wearing these like exactly the same like little cloth tied onto their hair and onto their wrists and onto their foreheads, and like it was like whoa. And it was complex for me, because like I said, it was at first it was like really beautiful. You know what I mean? It was like these kids, like they believe in their own voice, and they believe in the power of the Jewish family, and they believe that they can have an influence on the government, and they are out there because they don't think it's a waste of their time. On the other hand, we all know what happened, right? We all know that all these voices were did not win the day, and that today we still suffer the aftermath of what happened in Gush Katif. Not to mention the fact that the lives of hundreds of people were really badly wounded, if not destroyed. These nice people who didn't do anything to anybody, who had their houses like ripped out from under them. And there were a lot of people had heart attacks and divorces and children with problems and all kinds of things. They suffered a lot of trauma, the families of Gush Katif. But also all of us, we've had multiple wars with Hamas. They shoot rockets literally like from the foundations of the homes of Gush Katif. And we don't have access now. Jews, we don't have access to the beautiful beaches of Gaza. You know, Yisha, you and I used to go swim on the beach of Gaza.
Mm-hmm.
With the beautiful orange shells that used to be lining the whole beach there. So also seeing these kids and seeing all their hope and all their like youthful energy and all their innocence. And then knowing that sometimes that does not win, that was also very painful for me, seeing these kids and knowing that they don't understand, they haven't been through, thank God, they haven't been through a scenario in which, like, they're like all what they've been taught about, like, the power of the Jewish state and the, like, the commitment of Jewish people to each other and how good will prevail. That it doesn't always happen, at least in the short term, right? At least we don't win every battle. I guess that's the real point. I think today, Baruch Hashem, that the Jews of Israel do understand what happened in Gush Katif, and I think that there is a lot of remorse for a very big failure of Gush Katif, and it doesn't look to me today like we're headed towards something like that again. Thank God. But anyway, so that was like a moment that I had there today in the street. But mostly it was beautiful. Mostly it was happy. And looking at all these like hundreds of kids that we have just in one town, and knowing that they like are excited about the future and they believe in themselves and they believe in their state and they believe in their God to protect them and help them on their way is wonderful and exactly what we wanted.
And also our daughter Leah got a piece of mail from the city of Jerusalem.
Right. Not connected to the Gush Katif story, but I guess kind of connected to the
Jerusalem. I was connecting the optimism and the thing that you were talking about is like, and it is connected. It's not about Gush Katif, but it's about living in the land of Israel, living in the state of Israel. And here comes a letter from the municipality of Jerusalem.
Right. So Leah got a letter from Jerusalem this week. And I didn't open it because you know how much kids like to get mail, right? And I was like, I wonder what this is. Maybe it's some like erroneous school registration thing, you know, for Jerusalem. Maybe they like, I don't know, they got our address or something. So I left it and I was like, kids love to get mail. I'll let her open it herself. So finally she got home and she opened this thing. And it was a certificate, a small certificate, but on like a nice cardboard with like a gold embossing of the emblem of the city of Jerusalem. And it said, Mazel Tov on your bat mitzvah.
Mm-hmm.
That in our records, it shows that you have come to the age of mitzvot, 12 years old for a girl, right? And they had her birthday, they had her name, and they had her birthday. And they like wished her a Mazel Tov on her bat mitzvah. It was a certificate of Mazel Tov. And I thought that was the cutest thing. And they included in the, along with the certificate, a pamphlet explaining that they are keeping a record of every person born in Jerusalem.
Mm-hmm.
And I was like, wow. I mean, that was just like such a beautiful, happy, proud. And it was kind of like a form letter, right? It was like even a form document. I mean, it did have my daughter's name printed on it and her had her birthday printed on it. So it was customized for her, but it was like came from the office, you know, and I guess they mail all these things out all the time to different kids. But I just thought to myself, wow, you know, the city of Jerusalem has on record that my daughter was born in the city of Jerusalem And it like wishes her a mazel tov that she's come to Gila Mitzvot, that she's come to the age of adulthood, of being a bat mitzvah. And I just love that. That made me so proud.
Nice. Amazing. What else, Malka? What else is on your radar screen?
Well, I just wanted to say that I wanted to wish you a mini mazel tov, Yishai, because I know that you had like a big event this week. You had some important congressmen in Hebron.
It's true. I had both congressmen, Representative Mike Johnson from Louisiana, Republican, and also Jim Jordan from Ohio. He's a Republican there also, kind of a staunch defender of President Trump. And I took them. They were actually part of the Yes Israel Project tour, which did a lot of things, including Shiloh and the City of David and the Mount of Allah and the Temple Mount. And all kinds of, and they met with Prime Minister Netanyahu, a lot of stuff. But along the way, I had them for a few hours under my kind of control, and that was
under your wing,
under my watchful eye of showing them really the story of Israel. And first, I took them to the famous Chavat Ma'on, which is the Ma'on farm, part of the Ma'on community in the southern Hebron Hills. We met there a great butcher, who's also a land, homesteader, and he's got cows, and he's got goats, and he's a shepherd, and he does all this stuff, and he's also a, like, 10th generation Jewish butcher.
What? Sephardi,
his grandfather was the Iranian Jews' number one butcher. He was like butcher for the king type of thing, whatever it is.
Butcher and for the king.
Something like that.
Which is a great book title.
Right. Kind of. And then
butcher for the king. It's a little bit of an angsty story.
Yeah.
And sort of like Romeo and Juliet, but like everyone lives.
Right, but Jewish. Here we go. And he was Jewish, and he's very Jewish. And he's got another side, which is from Syria, but he grew up in Texas.
Wow.
Anyway, so, I mean, well, the best thing is we went to their beautiful Moroccan-style synagogue with lamps from the Sinai. And
what do you mean, lamps from the Sinai?
They, like, there's these Moroccan-style, like Marrakesh-type lamps that they went down to Sinai to buy them because they're so beautiful. And then from there, we went on the fork, kind of not four-wheel drive, but we went on the tough vehicles out into the desert just to show them where the edges of the desert and where David shepherded his flocks. And the best part about it is that one of the vehicles was a big Dodge Ram.
Ooh,
and they were like,
yeah,
and I'm like, America is helping us settle this land. Look at that Dodge Ram with two shofars. Okay.
Nice.
Okay. And they were like, hell yeah. And then from there, we went to Hebron. And we went to the museum in Hebron, the Chevron. We went to see the wonderful story of the Jewish people's 3,800 years of presence. We gave them lunch. We fed them lunch. I organized the lunch for them and then took them into the tomb of the fathers and mothers. I forgot to mention, by the way, that both of these representatives, these congressmen, had their wives with them as well.
That's nice.
Polly Jordan and Kelly Johnson. And when I took him into the tomb of the fathers and mothers and told him about the fathers and the mothers together, they really choked up. They got teared up. So that was really great. I really feel quite honored. And that is also related to the fact that next week I'm flying out Monday night and heading towards Washington, D.C., where I'm going to be running an event together with a lot of great organizations, Young Jewish Conservatives and Chovevei Tzion. And myself and a few others were coming together to do a night to honor Judea and Samaria in something called the Israel Heartland Reception. The Israel Heartland Reception at CPAC. Slogan is, I heart Israel's heartland.
That's cute.
I'm excited. And so...
Is it going to be food there?
There's going to be some sushi. And there's going to be...
Oh, my gosh.
There's going to be a lot of snacks from Eretz Yisroel.
What, like Beasley?
Yeah, Beasley and Bamba.
Ooh, yeah.
Except for those people with the peanut allergy, don't be in the room. We're going to have that. I'm going to have a video. We're going to have speakers. We're going to have a prize. We're going to have a great prize? Time. Yes, beautiful, beautiful prize. Nachman Mostavsky from Chovevei Tzion just made this gorgeous prize.
What does it look like?
I gotta show it to you. It's quite creative, and just gonna be a nice prize. We're gonna be giving it to Mark Meadows, very famous congressman from the so-called Freedom Caucus. And anyway, it's gonna be really neat, and everybody's invited to join up. by joining. And the way you do it is by I'm going to put it up on my Facebook page immediately and people can sign up. But basically it's Thursday night, 6 p.m. Residence Inn at National Harbor, Maryland, close to Washington, D.C., right outside of CPAC. Going to be a really neat event. I'm excited. Neat. Yeah, I'm excited. So that's great. So thanks for that. Congratulations. Anything else, Muck, on your radar?
Well, I think that's the really good stuff. Mm-hmm. I have also on my list that we're supposed to talk about a new phenomenon of health awareness control here in the state of Israel, which is the new seemingly law about how Israel displays its cigarettes.
Yeah, it's not maybe a big topic for it, but I was just pretty amazed. I went into a gas station recently. And, you know, our gas stations have these little stores attached to them.
Everyone has them. You know, in America, we Ishai, it makes me feel old, but I feel like we've been in Israel so long that we've seen so many different changes. Like, it used to be that you would go to the gas station, and at the gas station, you could really only get gas. Sometimes you could also get bottles of water or coals for your mangal, for your little barbecue. But that was basically it. And since we've made Aliyah, which was in 2003, Israel has like reinvented its gas getting. And it's basically like the American system where you have like all these little convenience stores attached to the gas station.
Anyway, now cigarettes are not displayed that you can see them anymore. They're behind this like flip down cover. You got to like push down the flippy cover on springs in order to reach the cigarettes. And people have to kind of like... They kind of have to say, like, I want Marlboro Lights or whatever it is. Now, I'm going to admit something that is not always something that people love to hear. But, like, in my life, I had periods of time that I smoked cigarettes. I come from my father was a cigarette smoker. And it's a very unhealthy thing to do. And I'm 100%.
Do not do it, children listening to the show.
It's just...
It will make you stinky.
Minimally, it'll make you stinky, but... maximally it'll make you die and it's just not a good thing. But I was just amazed at the level of like they really wanted to crack down on this thing.
Yeah, it's like a whole different thing. And I haven't been in America since this summer, but I venture to say that Israel is more hardcore than America is now about cigarettes. We have like a local liquor store. I don't like the word liquor store because it makes it sound like shady.
Beverages,
I'll call it alcoholic beverages for Shabbos store.
Maybe the word liquor is not a bad word.
I know, but it just feels
weird.
What
about wine and spirits?
Okay.
Yeah, wine and spirits. What's wrong with
spirits? No one ever asks for, do you have any spirits?
But you go into a wine and spirits store.
All right. So anyway, there's a local wine and spirits store.
I can't believe you said that. Yeah. Anyway, yeah.
And I like, because I go in there sometimes, so I know the...
Let's just tell the truth. You go in there to buy me liquor.
I buy you alcohol for your Sabbath. And plus, you like, you're overly sharing in the shul, so then we run out of alcohol very fast.
Right. Well, because I talked about in the last part of the show that I go to this Chabad shul, Shabbat morning after shul, we kiddish. Yeah, we sit down.
We save some l'chaims, but
we like sit down for an hour. Okay,
yeah,
we sit and schmooze for an hour, and that's one of my favorite things about my whole Shabbat here.
So there's a really cool guy who works at the alcohol store. His name is Yehuda, and he has his head is shaved on both sides, except for the middle is left like a mohawk, but it's not like the mohawk of the 80s that stands straight up. It's like Israeli mohawk, which is like they leave it long and then they put it in this like bun type of thing. So you look a little bit like a samurai. Maybe it's called a samurai haircut. I don't know. But anyway, the guy is named Yehuda and he's got the samurai haircut. But he's like a real Jewish guy, you know what I mean, at the same time. So I go in there. I'm like, hey, Yehuda, what's up? And we talk about stuff and he's married. And he lives in Tekoa, and I talked about a parenting class I went to one time. Like, we talk about stuff sometimes because the alcohol store is not always so full. Anyway, one time I went to check out, and I see this, like, accordion thing over the top of where I remember the cigarettes to be, which I never, ever buy. But I notice them there all the time.
Right.
So I'm like, dude, Yehuda, what's going on with the cigarettes behind you? And he's like, look at this. He opens it up It is, everything looks the same. You can't even tell what you're looking at. There's many little cartons, just like,
the packs themselves.
The packs are all there. They're right. All displayed there, except you can't exactly see them. All you can really see is what's printed on them. Every pack of cigarettes now for sale in Israel has a giant full size, meaning to say it covers the entire top to bottom mm-hmm. of the cigarette pack, a big warning about how you're about to die and how horrible this is for you if you're going to buy this thing. And all of those warnings are identical. So it's from top to bottom. All the packs are displayed top to bottom, right? So you're just looking at a huge wall of many tiny warnings about not smoking. And you can't see the brands even. Like, I wouldn't know if I was born yesterday and I opened the thing and I saw the thing. I wouldn't know it was cigarettes. But B, I wouldn't have no idea what's a Camel cigarette. What's another brand?
Marlboro
cigarette.
Parliament.
Okay, very good. You should call it Kavod. So I would have no idea. You know what I mean? That's like a big... I remember from growing up in America, like the branding and the logo or whatever, that's a big part, and the colors and everything.
Right.
That's like a big part of the advertising of cigarettes, but you're not like, you can't see any of that anymore.
Right. Altogether.
So Israel's really trying hardcore. Certainly you're not allowed to smoke in many public spaces and government run spaces and everything. Israel's trying to really crack down on smoking.
Okay, so the bottom line of all your stories, except for the congressman's stories, is really about the future, about the children, about Jerusalem sending out that bat mitzvah mazel tov card, about remembering Gush Katif and about moving towards the future and about protecting our children from harmful things.
I just want to say one more little thing about the Jerusalem certificate. One thing that moved me about that certificate is that we don't live in Jerusalem. We don't live in Jerusalem anymore. It's not like you get your like electric bill and then you get your bat mitzvah certificate. Right. You know what I mean? Like in the same thing. It's like they went and found us and they were like, I guess I could have been in the Golan, right?
Yeah.
And they would have been like, but you were born in Jerusalem.
Because just to make it clear, we see Jerusalem out the window. It's
right.
It's,
but we're not. We're not in the city of Jerusalem.
Between us and Jerusalem is the city of Bethlehem.
Right. And it reminded me of the Psalms, which says that one day it's going to say like, Ish Yuladba. Like it's gonna like say like this man and this man was born in Jerusalem,
right. or that all of us were born really. That's what we're
interesting.
Really
I always think of it differently as a count. Like this one, right. It'll be a source of great pride for each person that they were born in.
Shai Agnon, when he received the prize, the Nobel Prize, he basically was like, "I was born in Jerusalem, but my body, because of the exile, was born in like
right."
You know, some right, but he's like, but really, really, what my soul is, it's from Yerushalayim.
Right.
That's what his point was. All right, folks, you are listening to the Yishai Fleisher Show. Malka Fleisher, thank you so much for joining us, and thank you for all those great stories about a Jewess living in the land of Israel,
yes,
feeling
that's
those
what
feelings,
I am.
Raising those children, and moving the project along. Yasher Kochech, may you have continued strength.
Amen.
And God bless you, folks, wherever you are. Write us an email, yishai@thelandofisrael.com. Come to the CPAC event. That would be great. Come to Hebron by going to hebronfund.org and going on one of our incredible trips, weekly trips to Hebron. Also stopping off at the Tomb of Rachel. Check out our sponsors at Tchelet, T-E-K-H-E-L-E-T, the True Blue Jew String. Rabbi Mike Ford just got his new pair. I saw it swinging during Mincha today.
Nice.
Okay, and it was great to see a lot of people really getting around here. More and more Tchelet is the way to be. And if you're just all white, you're just...
God bless you anyway.
Yeah, just God bless you. What else? Oh, yeah, and this amazing radio station called the Land of Israel Network with so many great shows. We love to hear from you. We love to be part of your life. We love to, you know, I sat with a wonderful couple from Saskatchewan, and they're listeners to the show, and they told me about their life, and their life is one that's very, very much in nature. They even once a season hunt buffalo and eat it. And they, that's right.
Wow.
And they
what do they do with the fur?
They use every part of it. They use every part of it. They sell the fur. This and that.
I'm so glad to hear that the buffalo are out there, though.
Yeah. Oh, yeah. They're out there. And so, and it's very, very controlled. And it's not like people are killing them left and right.
Right. Yeah, I think that's probably it's very, very regulated.
But the point is, you know where they get their spiritual sustenance? Mm-hmm. Right here,
wow,
yo.
Right up in here.
That's right. So there you go. So God bless you wherever you are. Stay tuned. Stay strong. And have a great, great Shabbat wherever you are, whoever you are. You are part of the story. Lots of love from the land of Israel, the land of blessings. Malka, Shabbat Shalom.
Shabbat Shalom.
God bless you, and Shalom. Bye-bye.
Hi, this is Eve Harrow, host of Rejuvenation on the Land of Israel Network. You can hear a new show from me every Sunday and every day of the week. Shows from another one of my very talented fellow show hosts. Reach me, Eve, at thelandofisrael.com. And keep listening, everybody. We love your feedback. The Land of Israel, coming at you every day, every week. That's the Land of Israel Network on thelandofisrael.com.